So, good evening. We are going to talk about equanimity. It's the last of the seven factors of awakening. I think the way I'd like to do it is for the first couple of weeks here, this week and next week, we're going to talk about it just generally, this idea of equanimity. And then the next 2 weeks, talk about it more as an embodied practice, these seven factors. Not so much as just an intellectual practice, but how do we practice this as an embodied practice? Because I don't think we awaken unless we're embodied. Somehow or another, we have to figure out how to actually embody what it is that we're practicing. So, but I don't think that equanimity is as difficult to describe, to explain it, as concentration. I think the difficulty with equanimity is to experience it. Somehow, it's difficult to experience it, almost to the point where I'd say we may not even want to experience equanimity. There's a way in which the way we talk about equanimity, nobody really wants to live that way. Let me help you understand what I mean. So, I looked up some of these words in the dictionary. Equanimity. And the dictionary describes it as calm emotions when dealing with problems or pressure. You know, an evenness of mind when we're under stress. And as beautiful as that sounds, when I think about when I'm stressed or when I'm under pressure, I don't necessarily have this calm, abiding mind. That I may want that, but that's not what actually shows up. What shows up is a raised voice and a heightened kind of pressure, kind of way that I talk. So some of the words that are connected to this equanimity is words like calmness, cool, composure, repose, or my favorite is imperturbable. Yeah, that would not be the way I describe myself when I'm under stress. Anyone that's ever been around me and knows that I'm stressed, what they would say immediately is that you are perturbed. They would know it. I know it. So this idea that I could experience equanimity in this calmness, evenness under stress, it doesn't make any sense. There's a collection of works called the Abhidhamma, which is more, it takes the Buddha's the Pali canons, and it gives it all this detail. So it's a later body of work that came several hundred years after the Buddha, a much more detailed description of all these things we practice with. And the Abhidhamma describes equanimity as neutrality. So I thought, oh, maybe that's it. You know, I think of neutrality as impartial. I want to read a quote here from Shanti Deva, one of my favorite teachers. And I think the way he describes this, what I think the Abhidhamma is pointing to with neutrality. He says that whatever happens, I will not let my cheerfulness be disturbed. Being unhappy won't get me anywhere and will dissipate all my goodness. So why be unhappy about something if you can change it? And if you can't change it, how will being unhappy help? I think that's what the Abhidhamma is pointing to. That there is a thing that has happened that could disturb my cheerfulness. And then there is my cheerfulness. Right? Can you see there's two things here? There's the thing and there's my cheerfulness. And whatever this thing is, I'm not going to let it disturb my cheerfulness. So I looked up neutrality, thought, okay, this I'm a lawyer. We're like taught to be impartial. Let's look that up. And this is why I think we don't do equanimity very well. Neutrality is described as a neutral color. It's not bright, it's not strong. It's not supporting either side. So it's like a neutral state of power. It's not decided or pronounced as a characteristic, so it's indifferent. It is neutered, lacking of stamina, not electrically charged. And some words I thought I would pick out. It's not aligned, it's hands-off, beige, faceless, dull, flat, and my favorite, humdrum. I thought, it's no wonder we don't want to... We have this idea, this some kind of mental construct of what it would be like to be equanimous, to be in a way even-minded in the face of stress. But when we think about equanimity in this humdrum kind of bland, neutral way, no one really wants it. It's like a mental idea of something I'm going to get to, maybe this lifetime, maybe a couple of more. It's going to take a while to let go of all my wants. And so tonight I want to see, or tonight and next week we'll go deeper into this, but I want us to see if we can begin to consider that is not the equanimity that the Buddha was pointing to in the awakening factors. That equanimity that's described in Webster is a thought about what equanimity is. It is the thinking mind's version of equanimity, but it is not embodied equanimity. The equanimity that arises under the awakening factor when it's embodied, that equanimity would be the heart's version of equanimity. And that's what we want to talk about, is this heart's version. Sharon Salzberg said that the difference between misery and happiness depends on what we do with our attention. That right there is the difference. When we are attending to equanimity based on what our thoughts are about what we should be, what it should look like, we are going to get stuck in misery because we are never really going to be the calm, even, walking on water kind of person in the middle of stress. Here's another way, though. I don't know if you guys, I love Milarepa, and mostly because he seemed like a pretty angry guy, and I was pretty angry, and he got enlightened, so it's like all possible, right? So I don't have to worry about it, so I love it. He says that the gap between thoughts allows non-conceptual wisdom to shine continuously. So there's a gap between our thinking, between the thing that is disturbing us, and our image of what we think equanimity is. If we put our attention on that space, I think there we can begin to see the equanimity that Buddha was pointing to in the awakening factors. So not on the thing that's disturbing us, and not on this image of what we think equanimity is, and more in this gap in between the two, this non-conceptual wisdom that will allow us to see something different. That's what I want to talk about. So a couple of ways I think we can look at it is we can first think that gap of understanding of equanimity, think of it as a result, not as a thing that we become. So it's not something I need to get or I need to figure out how to be. It's a result of our practice. I don't know if I read this sutta to you guys the last week, but when I was talking about concentration, but there is a sutta that I love, and it talks about this. It's a long sutta because it goes through all the seven factors and all the different layers of these seven factors. So I just took out the small part. I mean the last part that relates to having a concentrated mind and equanimity. But what the sutta is basically saying is, it's not a force of will to be equanimous. It is a natural state of the mind that arises out of a concentrated mind. So the sutta goes, for a person whose mind is concentrated, there is no need for an act of will. May I know and see things as they actually are. It is the nature of things that a person whose mind is concentrated knows and sees things as they actually are. For a person who knows and sees things as they actually are, there is no need for an act of will. May I feel disenchantment. It is the nature of things that a person who knows and sees things as they are, as they actually are, feels disenchantment. For a person who feels disenchantment, there is no need for an act of will. May I grow dispassionate. It is the nature of things that a person who feels disenchantment grows dispassionate. And for a dispassionate person, there is no need for an act of will. May I realize the knowledge and vision of release, this felt sense of equanimity. It is in the nature of things that a dispassionate person realizes the knowledge and vision of release. The Buddha goes on to say, in this way, mental qualities lead on to mental qualities. Mental qualities bring mental qualities to their consummation. And for the sake of going from the near to the far shore. So what I think he's saying here is that in some respects when we're practicing, if we're practicing from this intellectual trying to be a certain way, then there's this force of will, this may I, this I need to, this should be way that we practice. And we practice trying to achieve or become a certain thing. Certain person, certain way. And then, of course, every time something upsets us and we get off balance, I'm not there yet. I'm not good enough yet. I haven't figured it out yet. And there's all this disappointment in our practice, as if our practice isn't quite good enough. Because if it was good enough, I would not be disturbed about anything. I would be imperturbable. But to put this in more perspective, if we think about equanimity as a result, not something that I need to force into being, then we have to put this into perspective with something called the vicissitudes of life. Vicissitudes are the We also call them the eight worldly winds, the four pairs. These pairing of things, which is gain and loss, and pleasure and pain, and praise and blame, and fame and ill repute. Those four pairs go on in our lives all day long. They are coming and going. We get and we lose. We feel pleasure and we feel pain. Somebody praises something we did and somebody blames us for something. And we get this fame and, oh, everybody's talking about us. We like that. Everybody loves us. And then we can't seem to please anybody. And the rumors around us are that we did something wrong. So these four pairs also fuel all our prejudices, all our preferences, all our desires, all our biases in life, everything. Because it's pretty easy to see, we want the praise, the gain, the pleasure, the fame side. We don't want the other side. We want that good side. And so everything in our life, I'd even go so far as to say probably like 90% of our lives is spent trying to be on one side of these worldly winds, of these vicissitudes. But when you really understand the vicissitudes, these four pairs are whipping us up all life. It is the nature of our lives that these conditioned experiences will be around us all day long. So our reactivity is really in the pushing and pulling of trying to get on one side or the other, or staying off one side and getting on one side. What we're really trying to do, I think, with the equanimity as a result is not to try to make ourselves equanimous, but we are practicing on the cushion to cultivate concentration so that when we go out in the world with these worldly winds and these vicissitudes, equanimity or an equanimous mind is what arises in the midst of it. It's almost like you have to be willing, not easy to do, but you have to be willing to investigate and be with and practice with all the things about you that you don't like. Because all the things about you that you don't like is only present because there is a worldly wind close at hand. Meaning that there is something, some pain or gain, I mean some gain or loss, some pleasure or pain, some praise or blame or fame or ill repute that you're trying to struggle with. And in the midst of that struggle, that's where you can see all your reactivity. So when we see that reactivity, the idea would be, can you allow your practice to let you be with that reactivity? Because something happens when you're with reactivity. What Ajahn Chah said, to observe and watch one's own mind is something really interesting. The untrained mind will run and follow its old habit patterns, but it has not been trained and taught, so it will get lost in all kinds of stories and issues. Therefore, we have to train our mind And the meditation practice in Buddhism is all about training one's own mind. We could practice all day long, day after day after day after day after day. We could sit on that cushion and we could get a still mind. But how would you know it was still? How would you know? I mean, the only way we really know whether the mind has gotten still or not is we have to rub up against something that would otherwise shake us. So it's almost like when I listen to people talk about their practice with me, they don't talk about, they don't say it like, I'm doing really good, everything's great, it's all perfect. It's more like, I used to do this and now I don't. I don't really know how it happened, but somehow, in this practice, I no longer do whatever. That somehow the result of my practice is what I notice. We don't notice the stillness in the mind until we see it in relation to something we used to do. And then we can see, oh, I'm stiller now. I'm quieter now. It's the result of practice that we begin to see into possibility of equanimity. But this result that we see, it's not even us doing it at the time. So even when people explain to me that they know practice is working, because they no longer get so overreactive about things. It's not even in the moment that they would get reactive that they notice it. It's after they didn't get reactive that they notice it. Like somehow or another, I did not react the way I normally would. Because it is the result of practice that we're looking at. And this is not something you can control. This is something that arises out of your diligence and practice and not out of something that you have a force of will to make happen. So, in some respects, when you look at this equanimity as arising out of a result of practice, then the opportunity for you to actually awaken only comes when you see that you have rubbed up against something and you did not react. The awakening aspect of equanimity is not something you're trying to be. It becomes more awakening in the fact that you didn't do it. That you could begin to see that the mind can change and it has nothing to do with you making it happen. At least for me, that was the most important thing that I ever noticed. I had such a judgment about me that when I began to see that awakening was going to happen on my behalf and it had nothing to do with me. It had to do with the cultivation of my practice. It actually has to do with the cultivation of a calm and unified mind, a stable mind. You go through all of those awakening factors and you develop this culture, this concentrated, steady mind. And then when I went out in the world, my capacity to be with the world changed. I think I would go so far as to say, I still get pissed at the stuff I got pissed at before. I haven't even changed any of that. I still get upset. I still do everything. It feels like everything I am and everything I do feels the same. When I look in the mirror, I'm like, that's the same person I've been looking at in the mirror my whole life. And yet, when I notice in retrospect how I am in the world, it is not the same. There's something else that that points to, which is the other part of equanimity. You could think of equanimity not just as the result of your practice, but the equanimity that the Buddha is pointing to, I think, in these seven factors of awakening is really love. It's a different way of calling the word love. It's not the peaceful mind. It's not the sense of nothing bothers me. It's not that. That kind of reeks of indifference. But the equanimity that the Buddha is pointing to here, I think, is love. There is a capacity to be even-minded about life when you can love life however it shows up. There's a capacity beyond what we think of as the way we're supposed to be. One of the definitions I saw in relation to equanimity as upekkha, this love, describes it as an unshakable balance of mind that's rooted in insight. I remember one time talking to Joseph Goldstein. We were at one of the teacher training, and I was talking to Joseph, and Sharon was there, and we were talking about metta, and Sharon is describing metta, and the more she described it, the more I thought, you know, the whole of the practice is all about metta. It's just metta. That's all it is. So I asked Joseph, I said, you know, I think the whole of the practice is metta. I said, I don't really understand. When I said I think the whole of the practice is metta, then Joseph said, yes, it is, Tuori. I said, well, I don't understand. How come when you go on a retreat, metta is like the afternoon practice one time, right when you're sleepy, you really can't manage it. But the whole retreat is on this wisdom side. Let me train the mind, let me focus on the breath. I said, how come we spend the bulk of a retreat wrapped in the wisdom side and not the metta side? When we should be doing it flipped. Joseph said that they decided that if they had told everybody, come here to these retreats and I'm going to teach you how to love, nobody would have showed up. But if we say, come to these retreats and I'm going to teach you how to control the mind, manage and maintain that mind, everybody shows up. We can't wait to get in there and fix that mind. But it is, in mind training, it's actually cultivating metta. That's what we are doing. We are cultivating loving kindness. But if we think of it as loving kindness, we have a hard time. We think that somehow or another, there has to be some kind of mushiness to it. But the idea that the metta, this upekkha, this equanimity from loving kindness, without equanimity, just the idea of metta, compassion, mudita, it all can get out of control. I mean, the whole phrase that we have in our society now of compassion fatigue, that doesn't even make any sense to me that somebody can have compassion fatigue. Like, you're so compassionate. I can't take it anymore. I'm too compassionate. I can't even imagine that. But it can happen if you are not balanced in your mind with this quality of love. So, let me read another quote here. It's something I got from Philip, who, my favorite teacher, who's coming soon. He said that the understanding you gain from practicing gratitude, and let's just say equanimity in there, the understanding you gain from practicing equanimity frees you from being lost or identified with either the negative or the positive aspects of life, letting you simply meet life in each moment as it arises. There's a way that you can think about this if you've ever been attached to a child. Because I got a little granddaughter. And sometimes, she can push every single button that I didn't even know I had those buttons. They didn't even show up with my own kids. But with my granddaughter, the buttons show up. But it does not matter. Positive or negative, my capacity for love for that child is even. It's even. I don't even have to try to love her or try to be caring about her even when she is having a temper tantrum. I'm good with that. My capacity to just talk to her in the same voice doesn't come from something I have to try to make happen. It's because of this connection to love that I have. So we need to have this idea that equanimity is rooted in love. This awakening aspect of equanimity being rooted in love, so we do not create additional suffering. That's what this is about. Our reactivity creates additional suffering for both ourselves and everybody else. We have to channel, it says, this quote, I can't remember, where did I put this at? We're looking to channel all this energy that we have around any moment in time, any one of these vicissitudes. Can we channel that energy around knowing what is the thing that's most appropriate, most skillful, can be most helpful, and not have our reaction to this, you know, pair, one of those four pairs, being the thing that causes us the second dart. So the first dart is whatever showed up. And the second dart is our attention or reactivity to it. The thing we never talk about on that second dart is that the second dart is what leads us towards more suffering. It's what leads us towards more harm. I was talking to someone today, and you know, we came to this understanding that when there's when we have a kind of let's say something happens in our lives, some terrible thing, somebody does some harm to us, right? Just out of the blue, somebody does some harm to us. And there's a way in which we can then get reactive to that harm. It took a while for me to begin to understand that I'm not really responsible for that harm that comes to me. But I am responsible for my response. Whether that response is rooted in harm or aversion or greed or whatever, or whether it's rooted in kindness, I'm going to be responsible for whatever that harm is as a result of it. And it's beginning to actually pay attention to our own behaviors. So this kind of equanimity I'm talking about is an unworldly kind of love. It's not the kind of love that you would necessarily see in like a Christmas carol, like a Christmas, you know how all those Christmas shows that is going to show up over the next month? And I grew up watching those shows. And they are very moving, very touching. They emotionally stir the heart. I'm not saying that we don't need that kind of stirring of the heart in our lives. But that's not the kind of love that equanimity is pointing to. The kind of love that equanimity is pointing to is a little bit different. I want to give you a couple examples. I think some of you know that when I first started practicing, I had a serious problem with anger. I think I might have shared that before. But when I came to Sims, I came to Sims in 2001, right after 9/11. That's when I came and did my beginning class. And I did not think I needed a beginning class. I was really coming for my friend who I thought, I'll come help you, but I'm an old pro, been doing this a while. But I had a serious problem with anger. And round about that time, you know, Bush was in office, and the political situation and the way he, some of the policies that Congress did, I used to lose it without, I don't think I've ever shared this with you guys, but one time I was visiting my brother. My mother and I were visiting my brother, and I already did not want to go to their favorite store, the name being Walmart. That was their favorite store. I did not want to go to that store. But I go to the store, and I'm trying to hold myself together, be equanimous, force of will. I'm really going to be nice. And on our drive over there, we begin to talk about cars and the war in Iraq, and my brother made some flippant remark about, well, you know, some people are just going to have to die in order for us to protect our way of life. By the time I got out of that car, it was no more equanimity. Equanimity was gone out the window. I was literally screaming and jumping up and down in that parking lot. I was so upset. But that is the way I had become. I had been so busy trying to make myself equanimous, and this anger, this rage was building up on the sideline, because in order for me to be the kind of equanimous person I thought I should be, I cannot really look at how I was actually being. So I'm trying to keep it together, and this rage is building on the side. So basically, I went to Rodney, we had a long talk about it, and I did all this work in order to deal with all this anger. But what I want to talk about isn't so much all the work I did. We can talk about that in the practice side of talking about equanimity. What I want to talk about is what happened to my relationship with President Bush. He became my neutral person in my Brahmavihara practice. He became the being that I held a neutral relationship with. Not my difficult person, not my easy to love person. He became the neutral person that I could begin to relate to. And because I think of that neutrality, meaning that my metta began to strengthen itself in relation to him, I turned my attention away from him and what I didn't like about the policies towards my own life and what I could do to make a difference. So during that period of time, I was going into prisons, even as a prosecutor, teaching meditation and nonviolent communications. I created this whole thing around teaching mindfulness on behalf of Sims to women's shelters at Jubilee House. I mean, I was doing all these things out in the world because my energy was no longer consumed with my anger towards Bush. Can you see what I'm saying here? There's a way in which if we do not begin to shift towards this unworldly love, capacity for unworldly love, then we stay consumed in the vicissitudes of life. We stay consumed in that pulling and pushing of gain and loss and pleasure and pain and the rest of them. But instead, I turned my attention away from that towards my own life and what I could do to make a difference. And the only way I could do that is out of this unworldly love that we all have the capacity for, but we never really give ourselves permission to step into it. So one more quote here. It's by one of my beloved teachers, Buddhadasa. He says, the entire cosmos is a cooperative. The sun, the moon, and the stars live together as a cooperative. The same is true for humans and animals, trees and the earth. When we realize that the world is a mutual interdependent cooperative, when we realize that the world is a mutual independent cooperative enterprise, then we can build a noble environment. If our lives are not based on this truth, then we shall perish. I was burning up with the anger I would not let myself see. And when I actually started turning towards it as a practice, which meant that I had to cultivate a steady mind in meditation so that I could have the steadiness we talked about last month to see things that are difficult and then have the neutral kind of capacity to actually see it as it really is, to see through it, to actually let the mind let it go and turn towards a more appropriate way to respond to the difficulties I was having with politics. So what this means is that we're beginning to see the Four Noble Truths that we talked about. We're beginning to see how everything we do is on the Eightfold Path itself. We can see the three characteristics, this impermanent, this natural dissatisfaction, and this non-self. And we can see the implications of karma. Not because we're trying to make that happen, but because the mind becomes steady enough that we can see it and how it shows up in just whether or not we start snapping at people because traffic is crazy. In a way, we can see that life is hard, gain, pleasure, praise, fame, that's all preferable? That loss, pain, blame, and ill repute? We don't want that. But either way, suffering around it, that's optional. That's what's optional. Not whether or not we have the vicissitudes. So I'm going to end with a poem here. I love this poem. And I have been waiting for the opportunity to read it. And it just never seemed to work. I keep putting a little sticky on it and say, get to that poem. But it never seemed to work. But I think it does, finally, with equanimity. Finally, in the course of this practice, it makes sense. It's called When I Taught Her How to Tie Her Shoes by Penny Harder. A revelation. The student in high school who didn't know how to tie her shoes. I took her into the book room, knowing what I needed to teach was perhaps more important than Shakespeare or grammar. I guided her hands through the looping and pulling of the ends. After several tries, she got it, got up, and walked out the door. Got it, walked out the door, empowered. How many lessons are like that? Skills never mastered in childhood. Simple tasks ignored. Let for years to go. This morning, my head bald from chemotherapy, my feet further away than they used to be, as I bend to tie my own shoes, that student returns to teach me the meaning of life, to simply tie the laces and walk out of myself into this sunny winter day. Is that not like the best poem for equanimity? We just tie our laces and walk out, right? Maybe you don't have cancer. Maybe you do. You don't have any say in it either way. But we all have to just tie our laces and walk out in the day. So let's sit a moment. Thank you for your kind attention. We'll see if you have any questions or comments. I'll leave you with something to think about, though. Would you really give up anything that's happened to you over the course of your life? If you knew that by giving up that one thing, you have to give up everything else. Would you give up all the bad things that happened if you knew that to give up that bad, you'd have to give up the good too? Somehow we kind of want to give up the bad, but don't get rid of any of the good stuff. But it doesn't really work like that. Anyway, so let me see if you have any questions or comments. Yeah.
I met Facebook, and you know, there's the political things, which is kind of one of the ways I get my political things, is I have friends who are posting important, pertinent things that are going on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have your choices.
Mm-hmm.
You want to respond. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what you're saying. You're saying, yeah, I don't want to be, you know, what was it?
Humdrum.
Yeah, humdrum. That sort of, to me, is part of that, you know. Or what you're saying, the danger is being just ignoring it, you know. So, but I find it interesting because at Bush, I did get, like, really impassioned, and I would just suffer under it. I would be a dying out, just like screaming almost over the injustice of the world. And now, and I've been practicing for 50 years, so it really does help. So now I'm 70, and everything is happening, and I can feel anger, but it doesn't consume me.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't take away my happiness. It's kind of paradoxical. I can feel strongly, but I don't. It doesn't rob me of my joy,
mm-hmm,
or my peace. It's strange.
I'm not quite sure. I think that was a comment, more so than a question.
It's a comment.
Yes, this kind of understanding that the longer you've practiced and the more you've let yourself be angry, the less that anger draws away from your peace or as Shanti Davis says, the world doesn't disturb our cheerfulness. That cheerfulness is in and of itself related to our practice, not to what's going on in the world. It's unconditional. And the conditions might be as they are, but it's unconditional, this cheerfulness, friendliness, or kindness, however you want to look at it. Yes, that's what I think the whole practice is. What I do want to point to, though, is that the practice is around practicing with anger. There's a way in which everything we experience in this urban life that we're living is part of the Eightfold Path. So everything that's coming up, everything, every experience, every moment in time is connected to our understanding or this greater understanding of the Eightfold Path. So whatever is prompting the anger, where I think I misunderstood the practice was, I thought that somehow or another I had to be calm with the anger. But that idea of being calm with the anger doesn't actually make any sense, because whenever I'm angry, I never felt calm. And I never knew how to be calm with anger. I don't think that the practice is pointing to that. I think what the practice is pointing to is, do you know the nature of anger? Do you know how it got there? Do you know what's keeping it there? Do you know what it is that, what are the conditions that lead to that arising of that? Do you know what the conditions are that leads to the maintaining of it and the conditions that lead to the ending of it? It's almost like anger is not of any value unless you want to begin to understand its nature. And if you understand its nature, it no longer has any kind of power over you. Because you know what it is. It's almost like kids that think there's a monster in the bedroom. They think the monster has more power over them. But you, as the parent, know that that is not a monster, that is actually close. At least I've never seen any monsters in there when the boys come running to me. So the idea is, can you get to know the nature of these emotions that are difficult for us such that they no longer have power over us? That is this capacity for equanimity. Not so much, can I get rid of the anger or am I calm with the anger, but just that I know whatever that emotion is, that defilement, whatever it is that has so much grip around me, I know it, I understand it. It has no power over me. That's equanimity. Mostly out of understanding that level of no power over me is going to come as a result of my practicing with it, and that I can maintain enough level of love or kindness, friendliness, whatever you want to call it, that I can be with something difficult without somehow or another cleaning it up, making it better so that it all looks good. That capacity is what enables us to liberate the mind.
So it's not pretending.
It's not pretending.
Right. Maybe even anger, there's something that you can have an impassioned opposition to something. That's different than anger. Maybe it's just understanding, too, our strong feelings.
Well, what was killing me was the aversion. It's not anger. I mean, anger is just an emotion like any other emotion, and we can begin to understand it. But the aversiveness and the hatred I had in relation to whatever I was angry about, that was killing me. That's what I really had to work on. Good. Yeah. Yeah.
Would you say those the aversion and the hatred are second arrows? Second arrows?
That's what I would say. Those are the second darts. That the anger itself could just be an emotion that arises in and of itself. When I first came into the practice, it seemed like everyone was saying, don't be angry, don't be angry. I'm a black woman, man. I got a lot of stuff I'm angry about. And I just was like trying my best, like, okay, don't be angry. Don't be angry. And I'm angry all the time. And it just doesn't work like that. Because it's like we pick and choose which emotions are okay and which ones are not. And we're trying to fit ourselves into that. It's no wonder that practitioners in the West sometimes are a little flaky and not real. Because we're trying to live in a kind of pretend world that we are more together than we are. And the idea is, the second arrow is that we're not really paying attention to where our attention is. Our relationship with this anger is far more important than the anger itself. Because I can be angry and I do not have to harm anyone. You can know I'm angry and not necessarily feel like I'm going to harm you. It's not the anger. It's the meanness that comes on the heels of that anger. And that meanness is my karma. That's what I'm going to have to live out. So I learned to just be with it. And in some respects, that first arrow, we are just practicing with the capacity to be with it. And I think the first, like, 6-7 layers of, I mean, 4-5 layers of the 7 factors of awakening is just about helping us be with that first arrow. And then the last, like the calm side, tranquility, concentration, and this equanimity is what helps us see through the delusion that we're actually experiencing in that moment. We can see through it when we're calm enough to stop reacting to it. But in order for that to work, it took forever. I mean, I don't even know how to describe it, but when I had my interview with Rodney about anger, I kept saying, okay, so I need to work on this anger. Rodney would be like, that's good, Tori. We'll work on the anger. I'm like, I need to figure out a way to get rid of it. And then he gave me this 15-20 minute Dhamma talk about letting it just be the way it is. Just let it be. And so you can have a capacity to investigate it and get to know the nature of anger. And after he gave me that 15-minute Dhamma talk, my response was, and then is the anger going to start going away? I think he was going to come out of his skin. He was like, he goes, Tori, you don't have to get rid of the anger. I'm like, you don't know how I am when I'm angry. I think I need to get rid of this. He goes, you don't have to get rid of it. You have to see it. And I'm like, he's like, don't say it. Don't see it, because I was just going to ask him, if I see it, will it go away? Everything in my mind, everything in our lives is based on this notion that there are certain ways we cannot be, and we have to get rid of it. By some force of will, we got to make it better. And the whole point of these awakening factors is to give you the reassurance that actually, really, it's like Buddha said, I mean this. You just have to know it is present and hold yourself steady enough to see it. Shine a light on it. Put some sunshine on it. And then you're going to see it's not really all of that. When we don't see it, it bothers us constantly. But when we see it, then you can see it for what it is. And that capacity to see it, you got to have a degree of kindness to be willing to be with what it is that you see, so you don't get thrown off by it. That, if it took me forever to believe what Rodney said, but he was spot on. I never actually had to get rid of my anger. I just had to be willing to be with that anger and see it. And know it's there. And know it can cause some harm if I react with it. But just steady yourself with it. Man. I don't know if you guys feel it, but I'm like, woo! If I was in church, I'd be shouting. Oh, God. Well, I just think that there's a way in which this practice is not taught in the liberative quality of it. But if this is a liberating practice, right? That's what we're practicing. We're not practicing this kind of, this kind of even keel going through life, everything's good. We're practicing something that's supposed to liberate the mind, awaken the mind, this enlightenment. That energy has to be more powerful than any kind of negativity that comes our way. It's the only way we're going to actually step into some of this negativity, is because the benefits of that awakened mind have to be more powerful than what we're afraid of. It is way more powerful. Good. You know I could go on, so now that I'm all stirred up, I could really. But we better stop here and have some announcements.